for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. According to psychologist Henry Kellerman, we spend much of our lives trying to manage anger, a process, he says, we are almost never even aware of. In a new book titled Personality, he details the unrecognized power of anger in all our lives and its critical role in determining our behavior patterns. Henry Kellerman on understanding how anger shapes us and different personality types. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good to have you here, Dr. Kellerman. You've written so many books. I'm looking at the latest, which is simply, as I said, titled Personality.
It's titled Personality, How It Forms.
Exactly. That is the subtitle. And I'll turn to you and ask, how does it form?
Well, if you ask a psychoanalyst, or if you want to know if we boil psychoanalysis down to one word, what would that word be? And that word would be remembering. Psychoanalysts want patients to remember. So I'm going to read a couple of sentences from the book. What is it we need to remember? Isn't it that each of us remembers different things, different experiences? Surely it can't be that we all do, in fact, remember the same thing. Or another way of putting it is to consider that when we do finally remember, is it possible that it is the same thing that we all remember? Diane, do you think that we can all remember the same thing?
Of course not.
Well, is that what we're getting at when we're asked to remember our past, that we're all the same?
Of course not.
Well, the fantastic answer, however, is yes, we will all remember the same thing.
And what is that same thing we will all remember?
Yeah, well, when we say what is that thing, are we talking about a table in the kitchen or a chair in the living room? Is that what we need to remember? Is the thing an inanimate object? No, the thing is an animate object. So it's a person. We need to remember something about a person. So as when we're all infants and as we grow into small children, if we round up the usual suspects, how many people in our population do we have to remember? We have to remember a caretaker or two, or maybe one or two other people, but generally a caretaker. And that usually is a parent.
And from that parent?
Well, from that parent, we begin to learn the most important word in any language. And what is that word? What's the most important word in any language, Diane? You tell me. It has two letters, and the first one starts with an N. What do you think it could be?
I
know you're very smart.
Right.
I know you're very smart. Yes, it's no.
And we remember that person who said no.
Well, let me expand that a bit. You're right, of course. But you see, with the no is accompanied a certain implication. And that implication is two words, or else. We always experience the or else. So that is known as the birth of compliance. Children begin to comply because they're always worried about a certain kind of experience that they don't want to have, just like all little animals don't want to have that experience with their mommies. And that is they don't want to be abandoned. The or else always refers to abandonment. And therefore, with these no's that we hear, we're constantly getting our wishes blocked because little children always want what they want, when they want it, how they want it, to what extent they want it.
However, the growth of sensibility, sensitivity, and maturity comes with recognizing as one grows that what you want may not be able to be yours exactly when you want it.
Well, that's exactly the point. And that's known as the ability to tolerate frustration and to postpone immediate needs for future goals. And that relates very much to maturity.
So you're saying that our personality type, which may divide into several pieces or may develop into different types of personality, is a better way to put it, all evolve from that idea of being said no to, and then how we deal with that no.
Yes, and that brings us back to the issue of anger that you talked about, because when the no is said so many times, wishes are blocked. The child can't have what the child exactly wants when it wants it. And when wishes are blocked, the child or the young child will become dissatisfied or moody or upset or stressed. All of them are code words for anger. And the anger is instantly repressed and forgotten. Why? Because of the fear of abandonment. You cannot be angry. You can be a little bit dissatisfied. You can show a little bit momentary dissatisfaction, but you really can't be rageful consistently and to a very intense level. If you are, then we call that a bipolar, you know, emotional disturbance.
But so if we, each of us, tries to remember back to those earliest days, I had Mary Lou Henner on the program the other day, one of apparently only a dozen or so people in this country who can remember not only everything she did, but everything she wore and every day it occurred back to the age of 3, which is also when people start saying no a lot.
Yes.
And hear no a lot because they're doing various things. She must be awfully overburdened with the consequences of having heard no, unless she didn't.
Well, the issue really involves this repression of anger because it is the birth of symptoms. See, we all have symptoms. Some are acute, some are chronic. If they're acute, they're likely to disappear more quickly. If they're chronic, they're likely to remain. But the fundamental issue...
Well, Dr. Kellerman's cell phone just went off.
I turned it off.
It's off for good now.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Good.
Okay, sorry. So the fundamental issue is when anger is repressed, you see, it's the birth of a symptom. No symptom can survive with repressed anger, whether it's a phobia or whether it's an intrusive thought or whether it's a compulsion or an obsession. No symptom can survive with repressed anger. The axiom or the self-evident truth would be, where there's repressed anger, not only will there be a symptom, there must be a symptom.
Tell me
where there is no repressed anger, not only will there not be a symptom, there cannot be a symptom.
Tell me about how you perceive your own personality development.
My own personality?
Your own personality.
Okay, give me some, in what respect? What do you mean by that specifically? You know, details need to be specific.
All right. Yeah, I'll be specific. The development of your own personality type, going back to your own childhood as a psychoanalyst. I realize you have been through psychoanalysis.
That's right.
And that's a very important part of your own growth and training. How would you describe your own remembrances of having heard no or else?
Well, as an only child from a middle-class Jewish family, you know, I was a little bit of a prince, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And only children have a kind of universal, ubiquitous characteristic, which we call grandiosity. Now, if the grandiosity is kind of limited and reality takes over, it could work wonders. If it prevails over everything else, it's no good.
Then it's a real problem.
Then it's a real problem. So mine, hopefully, was subservient to reality considerations, but with a mother and a father and an intact family telling me and being wonderful about all the things I did that I did well, and in addition to which I was an expressive and verbal child. So that was very important in my development, and also because I wanted to be a good boy, I guess, and my mother made sure that I'd be a good boy. So the no's were integrated reasonably well, but like everybody else in life, not perfectly.
Psychoanalyst Henry Kellerman, his newest book is titled Personality, How It Forms. A short break here. When we come back, we'll talk more and take your calls. And welcome back. Henry Kellerman is with me. He is a renowned psychoanalyst operating in New York. His newest book is titled Personality, How It Forms. And, of course, we are going to open the phones very shortly and hear all about your impressions, not only of your own personality, but perhaps that of others as well. We were talking earlier, Dr. Kellerman, about the word no, and you said it also implies or comes with or else. Alan from Lauderhill, Florida writes, the word no also represents the child's first sense of empowerment when he or she says no.
That's exactly right. And it also means that it's driven by a certain kind of angry impulse, because the angry impulse says, what do you mean I can't have it? Yes, I can have it. I want it. And so the no is driven by anger, and anger is always an empowerment, always an empowerment. Here's the personality of anger. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
If I can find it.
All right.
Yeah, the personality of anger. Okay, here it is right here. I have it. Anger has an aggressive drive. Like all primary emotions, it's inborn. Anger is expansive. It wants to get bigger. It has explosive potential. It wants to burst out. It has a confrontational inclination. It wants to get tough. Anger has an attack inclination. It wants to attack. It has an entitled frame of mind. It feels it has the right to get tough. Anger is an empowerment. It eliminates feelings of helplessness. So that anger is usually considered a negative emotion, but it's not always a negative emotion.
So when that child says no, that child feels empowered until the confrontation with parent or caregiver comes and says, yes, you will.
That's right.
So it's that balance between the expression of I will not with, but here are the reasons it makes sense.
Exactly.
So there's got to be some rational discussion. I just don't want parents thinking as they're listening to this that, you know, sort of intervening when the child says no is the wrong thing to do, because that child needs discipline as well as empowerment.
Yes, it's always a conflict with children growing up, with all of us. The conflict is between what we have to do, which is usually good for us, and what we want, which is not always good for us. So that, yes, of course, we have to comply. We have to comply.
What happens in your own analysis when that child begins to harbor anger for whatever reason, and there are a myriad of reasons why the child could harbor that anger. What happens when the anger becomes the dominant factor of a personality and how it forms?
Well, when it becomes dominant like that, we get certain diagnoses that are very detrimental to the person's functioning in life. For example, there's a diagnosis known as borderline personality, and it's a person with what we call a thin ego, and anger is constantly just a scratch beneath the surface, and it takes over the person's life. It's very difficult to live with such a person. And such a person usually winds up, very much alone. There are other diagnoses like aggressive personalities that are similar, psychopathic personalities. They're always riddled with a lot of repressed anger as well as a certain amount of anger above on the surface. So when anger takes over, like you're suggesting, it cripples the person emotionally.
But can anger be a positive motivating force as well?
Yes, but not if it's part of this diagnosis that I'm talking about.
I understand that. You're talking about an extreme.
Yes.
And now I'm asking you about the development of a normal, normal individual who has a certain amount of anger, but that anger is mostly under control, and that anger becomes a motivating force.
It does, of course, but I have to also offer a qualifier and say that it's very important to know the distinction between anger, aggression, and assertion. It's perfectly possible for people and desirable for people to be able to assert their needs, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's driven by anger. People need to feel entitled to assert their needs, but many people, I might even say most people, feel a little reluctant to do that for various reasons. And so usually that kind of assertion is driven by the anger, and it interferes and it distracts from the objective.
Let's go back to the young child and how parents can balance that reaction of theirs to the child who begins to say no as a development of childhood, as a development of a certain amount of maturity that happens when the child is quite young, how can the parent positively encourage that development while confronting his or her own anger that the child continues to say no?
Okay. You see, most people, all of us probably, like to solve problems. And problem solving, especially in a marriage, let me just sidetrack for a sec, in a marriage can kill the marriage. Problem solving is not a good idea.
Why not?
Because the best thing to do is to reflect the feelings of the partner. You see, problem solving means that you're not really listening. So going back to the thing with the child and the parent, if when the child is going through the no period, it's very important for the parent not to get angry, because they need to realize that the issue is not trying to solve the problem. The issue is to try to reflect the child's feelings by saying, oh, I see that you really didn't want to do that, rather than to say, you know, Johnny, it's not a very good idea to do that, because if you do that, Chicken Little might fall from the sky, and that's not a good idea. So it's much better to reflect the feelings. Continue to reflect the feelings, and that will help the child, and the parent won't get angry, because the parent realizes there are not two children in that room. There's a parent and a child, an adult and a child. So you can't take everything literally, concretely. You need to be able to be the parent, and that means being able to suffer inordinately as a parent and simply reflect the feeling and not expect the plant to grow immediately from the seed that you just planted. It takes time.
How can we, as adults, if we are having difficulty in our lives, begin to reflect back on those early years in a positive way to better understand ourselves? And here I'm not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars of psychoanalysis. I'm talking about how we do that on our own.
Okay, it's a tough question, because it's a tough task. Is it an impossible question and an impossible task? I'm not sure, but it's very tough. You have to have an introspective tradition in your personality. And if I ask you what percentage of the population has an introspective tradition, you might get stuck on that question, because few do. A small percentage of the population anywhere has a real introspective tradition. And that means that you have to sort of realize that current reactions to people very much are isomorphically, meaning a scale of 1 to 1, related to historical people in your life. And you have to make that connection. If you can make that connection, A, you won't get so angry, and B, if you can tolerate frustration, you can work with that.
Let's spell that out. Are you saying if you can recall a particular person, a particular moment, when that difficulty, that really agonizing tension arose between you and that person,
yes,
that will help you become more aware of what's going on with you?
Yes, it will help you become more aware, but in the following way. You see, we are all involved in struggle. What is the objective of a good psychotherapy? It's the same objective as life, as we have in life. The objective is to learn to struggle better, because it's always a struggle.
I cannot believe your telephone has gone off again. He's a busy man who's...
The phone is not working well. The phone is not working
well.
Well,
maybe Sandra can come in,
yes,
and get your telephone for you.
That's a good idea.
And I promise not to get overly angry about that. It is certainly an interruption, and one that we have a problem with. Here's an email which says, it's from Luke, who says, I wonder if your guest would include cultural remembering as the primary form of individual adult ways of being in dealing with anger. As persons, we are both greedy and communitarian, warlike and peaceful.
Well, that's a good question because it talks to the title of the book, and the reason it's a good question with respect to the title of the book is that the title of the book is implying how can we reform personality, how can we change, and the answer is actually with respect to culture is important because we all have a culture of our personality, and in culture. Culture is composed of traditions, and so the traditions in our personality very much are dependent upon the kinds of characteristics that we develop in our personality, which we call character traits. So with respect to the culture of the personality, we need to expand that culture and practice new forms of relating.
Psychoanalyst Henry Kellerman, his new book is titled Personality, How It Forms, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a great many callers waiting. I'm going to open the phones. We'll go first to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Love you.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you didn't get angry because it's only because your mother said no to you.
I think you're right.
My feeling about personality, I only had one daughter, but I've seen grandchildren grow up, is that their personality is pretty well intact when they come right out of the chute. That is, that first year before you're dealing with no's and such, they have a distinct personality, very different from their siblings and everybody else, way before you start forming them. And I love the terrible twos because they do say no. I don't see it as an angry gesture. I see it as an assertive gesture, saying what they want with a very limited vocabulary.
Well, that's very good that you see it that way, but when they say no, they're not saying with a smile. And it is assertive, but it's driven by anger. And yes, they come out of the chute that way. I think you're absolutely right. But we have to deal with epigenesis now, and that means that if the child is born with a certain kind of personality disposition and the environment in which the child grows supports it, and it's the kind of environment that reinforces that kind of disposition, then that disposition flowers into its full form. But if the environment is, let's say, contrasting to that, then we have a difficult problem, and the disposition that the child's born with will usually not prevail over the cultural environment. So the question is it culture over genes, or is it genes over culture? And I think the evidence is, surprisingly, that culture is very powerful.
So that if a child is born into a family with certain expectations, certain ways of behavior, if that child has differences of thought about behavior and tastes, for example...
Yes.
That child could be in some trouble within that family.
That's right. That's exactly right. So that, you know, this epigenetic issue of culture is very important. Very important, crucial. It will prevail over genetic endowment, even though the traits that the child is born with or the dispositional tendencies will still infiltrate, bleed into the child's functioning day to day. Yes. So it's a problem.
But that puts it at conflict.
Exactly. Exactly.
Here's an email from Jean in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Each member of the family may remember the same memory in different ways. It happens, and then it becomes a memory to the individual, and we each remember it often alter it slightly.
Well, it's a different issue because we're not discussing, or I'm not discussing the issue that whether all family members are focusing on one particular person's early memory. I'm simply saying that all of us individually are going to remember the same thing, not whether the father remembers the same thing the child remembers about the child. That's different. We're not talking about a group memory. We're talking about individual memory.
And so each of us is remembering our own
thing we need to remember, which is who blocked the wishes. That's why mother's always getting bad reports, because it's the mothers who are loving the child but are saying no a lot. And so every folk wisdom has this saying, no kindness goes unpunished.
The book is titled Personality, the author, psychoanalyst Henry Kellerman. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ally Bank, who values straightforward reporting and straightforward banking. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com. By Staples Copy and Print, with print products and services for businesses like brochures and presentations at Staples Stores or staples.com/copyandprint. And by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Sherry Turkle talks about how digital devices have altered our lives. For example, kids are texting more and talking less on the phone because on the phone,
you can't control what you're going to say, and you don't know how long it's going to take or where it could go.
Turkle is the author of the book Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Join us.
And welcome back. Henry Kellerman is with me. He's a psychoanalyst who has written numerous books. He's also written a novel titled The Making of Ghosts. But his newest book and the one we're talking about today is titled Personality, How It Forms. And we are going to go right back to the phones after I read this email from Jack in Ohio, who says, I suffer from passive aggression, and as the father of two young children, how can I keep from passing that trait on to my children? First, you might describe passive aggression.
Well, passive aggression is usually attributed to what's known as the passive aggressive personality. And there are three types, essentially. One is called passive aggressive passive type. One is called passive aggressive aggressive type. One is called passive aggressive dependent type. So I don't know which type you are. However, the objective of the passive aggressive personality is to make the other person angry. That's the objective. So as a parent, you have to be very careful, because your objective, if you're truly a passive-aggressive personality, is to make your child angry. And I would guess that you really don't want to do that. But emotions, you know, emotions, primary emotions, stand outside of civilization. Anger wants to attack. Fear wants to flee. Disgust wants to eject. So you have to be in civilization. And if we're in civilization, we know that you don't want to make your child angry.
So speak specifically to how this young father can check himself in relation to those young children.
Okay. You see, if it's a passive-aggressive, passive type, then what you will do to satisfy your objective in making the other person angry, in this case a child, unfortunately, is to be impatient. It's to delay. The delay is more characteristic. If you're a passive-aggressive-aggressive type, then you'll be impatient. If you're a passive-aggressive dependent type, you will begin to depend on the child, and the roles will be reversed. The child will become the parent, and you become the child in terms of your behavior. So you have to be careful of not being too impatient, not being a person who delays too much, and not reversing roles. In every one of those respects, anger will be the objective with respect to the child's reactions, because the child will get angry with any one of those kinds of behaviors toward that child.
Well, Jack in Ohio, I hope you take those words to heart. Let's go to Asheville, North Carolina, and another expression of anger. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm not here to express my anger.
I'm glad.
I love your show, Diane.
Thank you.
This is great. I wanted to say that I was cured of chronic back pain by a doctor, by an MD, whose theory is that 98% of human back pain is caused by the desire to distract ourselves from our own anger. And that I was cured in 1989, early 1990, and I have not had a recurrence of back pain since then. And by learning how, when I started to feel a twinge of pain over there near the sciatic nerve or wherever it cropped up, just think, okay, what's my state of mind? Am I angry? Am I angry at somebody? Am I angry over something that just happened recently? Just the realization that I am angry at something would cause that back pain to evaporate, to go away.
You know, you can argue it even the other way around, that your back is a good reminder to check what's going on in your head.
Yeah, of course, the way this caller describes it, it sounds like a psychophysiological disorder he had in his back, or what's known as a psychosomatic disorder. But we have to say that not all back pain is psychosomatic.
Right.
What happened to this gentleman, I think, is that, if you remember, I said at the beginning of the program that no symptom can survive if the anger is made conscious. You know, Freud said consciousness is curative. He was half right. Consciousness is curative only if what's made conscious concerns the repressed anger, but it's the repressed anger towards a particular who. Who was the other person toward whom you were angry? When you put your finger on that, the symptom cannot survive. And so this gentleman probably put his finger on that who.
Well, you also said earlier that quite often it is the mother who bears an awful lot of the direction of anger, because she's most often the disciplinarian who says, no, you can't do this. So are we going back to Freud and saying, everything is mama's fault.
No, what we're saying is that, well, maybe we are saying that, but not the point I'm going to make. The point I'm going to make is that the issue is who is blocking the wish. You see, we're all pleasure-soaked individuals. We want what we want when we want it and so forth, just like we did when we were children.
But if we have to go all the way back...
We don't have to go all the way back. We just have to make conscious the who in the current life who's doing it, and automatically, by a tacit assumption, it goes back to history. We just need to make conscious who is blocking the wish. The wish is the most derivative form of the pleasure principle in human life.
All right. I want to ask you, Dr. Kellerman, about a very sad subject, and I've read about this. You raised four beautiful sons, one of whom was murdered. How did you deal with the anger that must have come from losing that son?
Okay. You know, grieving in the psychological literature has a certain kind of process and phases. It's not all correct. People grieve differently. People manage going through this minefield, navigating it differently. It's not all the same. Some people will get angry at the person they lost because the person wasn't in the right place in the right time and so forth. Some people will just decompose and you can't put them back together. Humpty Dumpty can't get put together. It depends on the ego. It depends on how, what's the level of your protest. In my particular case, I say, I lost my son Sam, but I don't accept it. I do not accept it. I don't cotton very well to the word murder. I don't like the word death. I just say we lost him. And I don't accept it. I insist that the past doesn't necessarily verify reality, although I'm very realistic. In certain cases, I can protest. So my protest, I understand what happened, but my protest is very strong, and it's stronger than the event. Along with that, I have him with me all the time, you see, and I can talk to him, and I can see him, and he's still one of my four boys. So my way of dealing with it is that way. Okay? You didn't expect that, but you got it.
As a matter of fact, I appreciate it.
Okay.
And I think it is, in a sense, a very wonderful way to look at that loss. The book is titled Personality. Psychoanalyst Henry Kellerman is with me, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones, 800-433-8850, to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Julius.
Yes, good morning. I keep thinking there are more far-reaching effects of anger over our lifetimes. And I wonder if you know, decades of repressed anger, which could lead to heart disease, which could lead to stress, actually, and then lead to heart disease, if these are some of the more far-reaching effects, and how do we cope with these things?
You're absolutely right. I believe that repressed anger over decades is very dangerous for hypertension, for heart disease, for all sorts of things. But, you know, you mentioned stress. It's very upset. It's very interesting because I had a patient once that came in to see me, and I asked her why she was there. And she said, well, things happened that bothered me. I said, okay. I said, I thought I'd take a chance because you really can't tell people they were angry. They don't accept it. But I wanted to take a chance, and I said, well, I guess you feel angry at that, whatever it was. And she says, no, I don't feel angry. I just feel upset. Okay, so upset is a code word for anger. And people, you see, if you're upset, it's socially desirable. If you're angry, it's socially undesirable.
And what about depression? Is that the flip side of anger?
I wouldn't even say it's a flip side, but you're right. It's a synonym. And it's a displaced symbolic, you know, way of expressing anger. Anger has the largest glossary of any primary emotion. For example, dissatisfied, depressed, moody, bored even, frustrated, upset, and the cardinal synonym for anger that people use, this code word, stressed. Stress is nothing but feeling angry underneath. People don't want to know that they're angry, but they don't mind knowing that they're stressed. They don't mind knowing they're upset. Any word that is socially desirable is okay, but anger is not okay because it's socially undesirable. Even anger-related traits are socially undesirable. Sullenness is not desirable. Argumentativeness is not desirable. These are anger-related traits. Fear-related traits are much more desirable. Caution, for example, is considered desirable.
But you're talking about all of the ordinary feelings that all of us have, perhaps not every moment of the day, but certainly throughout the day, those feelings can come and go. And Julius is saying, you know, I worry, he's saying, that this could lead to heart disease or high blood pressure, as you mentioned. What do you do about it?
Well, one thing you do about it is to make a rather important distinction between major wishes and minor wishes. And the problem is we don't make these distinctions because every wish is major. If my alarm on my phone goes off, I better duck because Diane Rehm is going to get very mad at me.
But did I?
No, you didn't. But let's hope you don't get a symptom.
No, I don't
right.
think
okay.
I will.
Right.
But I think we're still at that point where we're hoping that through this conversation, people can become more aware
yes.
of those factors, which do happen and which do lead to very serious health problems.
So that if people begin to recognize that there really is a difference between major wishes and minor wishes, between real trouble and just aggravation. You see, with most people, there's no difference between trouble and aggravation. It's always trouble. And there's no difference between major wishes and minor wishes because every wish is always major. If you run to catch a bus and as you get to the door of the bus door closes and it takes off, you curse. Yeah, it's major. But it's really not major. It's just minor. And it's not trouble. It's just aggravation.
Thanks for your call, Julius. Here's an email from Gregory in Cary, North Carolina, who says, how likely is it that a person with anger issues can change his personality? Someone I know has alienated most of the people in his life because he cannot control his anger. What would the process of the friend be toward this person?
You know, Diane, we have to recognize, it seems to me, that there are certain things in life that not always can be easily addressed. And one is if someone's angry, very angry for a long period of time and just flips out at virtually everything and can't control anything, it could be a function of a certain diagnosis, which we call a borderline personality. And that is very resistant to talking cures. Some problems need medication, plain and simple. There's no doubt about it. I published a book called The Psychoanalysis of Symptoms, in which I describe two classes of symptoms. One is an acute symptom that people get and they come and go, and those could be cured through the talking method. But chronic, very chronic, lifelong symptoms really need medication. That's the way I would answer that.
So would you say to this caring friend, perhaps just being there for that person as opposed to actively trying to help that other person would be the better choice?
I'm not sure about that, Diane. I think that when someone's very, very angry, people don't stick around too long.
And that's clearly what's happening in that case. Psychoanalyst Henry Kellerman, his new book is titled Personality, How It Forms. Thanks for being here. It's been a pleasure.
And it's been a pleasure for me to be here. Thank you.
Right. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Megan Merritt. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program is a production of WAMU 88.5 from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Grant.